What I can tell you is that tonight's speaker is going to tell you how the ASA became great in the first place. Now, and I know Leslie will keep it great. But our speaker is particularly qualified to address this topic tonight, and I'm so delighted that you could be here. Ted Davis got a BS in physics from Drexel, and then his MA and PhD in history and philosophy of science from Indiana University. Spent a year in Vanderbilt, and then went to Messiah in 1985, and for 31 years has been in the teaching history of science. His specialty is science and religion. He's one of the top experts in this field. And he will be the first to tell you that he is not the historian scholar of the history of the ASA, but he knows more than anyone else about the context in which ASA came together and grew and became great. And so it is with great pleasure that I ask you to warmly welcome Ted Davis.
Thank you so much, Randy, for those remarks. My parents are no longer living. If my dad had been here, he'd have been proud, and my mother would have believed it. Mike Everest, thank you so much for the invitation to give this particular talk. I'll have some things to say about your grandfather, but I doubt you will learn anything new. I'm really delighted to have this role. No other organization has been more important to me than the ASA. I learned about the ASA during my first year of teaching science and mathematics at a Christian high school in Philadelphia. Frank Roberts, a longtime ASA member who is no longer with us, the friend who told me about the ASA, had a long, highly successful career in Christian education. If you also remember Frank, please raise your hand. Frank had a doctorate in geology, and he was also trained at Dallas Theological Seminary, which is a great combination for ASA. Frank soon introduced me to the late W. Jim Neidhart, one of the deeper thinkers in the organization at that time, and I was hooked. I received my first copy of the ASA Journal in September 1977, so I've missed being a 40-year member by just 1 year, and I've been a member then for more than half of the 75 years we're celebrating tonight. With gratitude to all those who came before me, I offer this short picture of the creation and evolution of the ASA. About 3 months before Pearl Harbor, the president of Moody Bible Institute, Will Houghton, invited five conservative Protestants in scientific fields to gather in Chicago to talk about the possibility of forming an organization, and I quote, of science teachers who are Christians, unquote, in order, quote, to help students confronted with secular textbooks and instructors. Forgive the technical difficulties, my slides aren't moving. Are they? Okay, now they are. I'm looking at a different screen than you are. Okay. Why was Will Houghton keen to start an organization of Christian scientists? Well, the answer is, at that time, conservative Protestants in the United States believed they were targets in a culture war, partly involving science and the Bible. The image you're looking at right now is apropos. It was published in 1927 For those of you who don't remember 1927, that's the year that Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs. And the year in which Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic Ocean. But in 1927, conservative Protestants had this vision of themselves, that the Bible, which they believed in and were supporting in the public sphere, was under severe attack. And it was under severe attack by the forces of modernity, the battleships of unbelief, including a couple of battleships right here in the middle, one called Science, and right next to it, one called Hypothesis. This cartoon appeared in the journal called The King's Business, which was published by the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, now known as Biola University, Bible Institute of Los Angeles. You see the initials. And that used to be located downtown, Church of the Open Door in Los Angeles. It's now, of course, outside the city in La Mirada. The dean of the faculty at Biola, at the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, the dean of the faculty at Biola at that time, was a very famous biblical scholar named Reuben Torrey, who had graduated from Yale College, where he had studied some geology under the great James Dwight Nahum, the greatest American geologist of the second half of the 19th century. He had not been a geology major, but he had sat through geology courses with Dana. And he was also the third and final editor of a set of publications between 1910 and 1915 called The Fundamentals. There were 90 articles in 12 paperback books sent to thousands and thousands of ministers and Sunday school teachers across the United States for free, paid for by oil money in California, two brothers named Stewart. So they were up to their ears with fundamentalism. The word fundamentalist was first used in the United States in 1920 in the context of liberal versus conservative Protestant theological battles. It was a self-chosen label by the conservative side. In the same sense in which today pro-life and pro-choice are self-chosen labels, whereas the other people have different names for their opponents. So the word fundamentalist was a self-chosen label of pride by the people who used it in this way, including people like William Jennings Bryan, the former presidential candidate, whom you will see shortly. We're having issues here, sorry, with the remote. If someone wouldn't mind sitting on the slides, I need the next one, please. Okay, there we go. William Jennings Bryan is on our right. On our left, the famous trial lawyer Clarence Darrow, who's been described to me by a very famous legal historian, Edward Larson, who teaches at Pepperdine, as probably the greatest American trial lawyer of the 20th century. Bryan was a three-time unsuccessful candidate for president of the United States as a Democrat. Very liberal Democrat, socialistic tendencies. If you don't know who he was, think of Bernie Sanders, and you understand in many ways who William Jennings Bryan was, except being unlike Sanders, he was not a secular Jew, he was a fundamentalist Protestant. And he identified with that wing of the Protestant churches. I could say a lot more about the Scopes trial, but I won't. But I want you to think that's part of the background for the ASA, because it was. This happened in 1925, in the summer of 1925, when it was hot in Tennessee there, as it is here today. And the affair was really hot on a national scale. What kinds of issues were being debated by Bryan and the fundamentalists concerning science, especially evolution? We need to keep in mind that that was the first generation in American history when nearly everyone had access to free public education through high school. And it's the first time in American history that evolution was front and center in the biology textbooks. This is the generation of the Scopes trial. And that's still the influence that's on the ASA founders in 1941. The Scopes trial had only been 16 years ago. Everyone here remembers the year 2000. Not that long ago. And that's how much distance there was between the Scopes trial and the founding of the American Scientific Association. The issues they debated included these, as you can see. The cartoons you're about to see are by the great cartoonist Ernest James Pace, who was one of the pioneers of the Christian cartoon. He'd been a secular political cartoonist in Chicago before his conversion to Christianity. And he drew cartoons every week for 3 decades for the very, very widely read periodical called the Sunday School Times, which went defunct in the 1960s. The Sunday School Times was a kind of combination, if you can imagine it, of Christianity Today and teaching manuals for Sunday school and world news. So it's hard to imagine that in a tabloid newspaper format that was mailed once a week to subscribers, a lot of subscribers in many countries. Subscriptions ran as high as 100,000 at various points in the 1920s and 30s during the Depression. So this was a very popular periodical. This was a big pulpit from which Pace put his cartoons, most of which have nothing to do with science. They have to do with the Christian life, difficulties Christians face, worldliness, failure to read the Bible on a regular basis, failure to take seriously the moral precepts of Christianity. Good Christian stuff for the most part. But he also cartooned evolution, especially when Bryan got his anti-evolution crusade off the ground in the year 1922. Bryan wanted to stop the teaching of evolution in publicly funded schools. That included public universities. And this was not just a high school proposition. Once the Scopes trial was based on a law passed in Tennessee a month earlier, in which it became illegal for professors at the University of Tennessee to teach evolution, because it was seen to be in violation of the biblical story of creation. The issues had to do with the things you're going to see in these slides. For example, in this slide, you see evolution depicted as hot air, and it's losing its hot air and headed toward a collision with facts. And the gondola of the balloon has a really significant label on it. Can you make out what the gondola of the balloon says? Science, falsely so-called. That's what it says. Science, falsely so-called. And this balloon is coming out of the clouds of speculation and headed toward a collision with the facts. This is a hard-headed Baconian view of science that I often call the Jack Hawes in one of our articles in Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith 25 years ago, in connection with the 50th anniversary, described as the dragnet view of science. You remember the dragnet program, police program here in LA? Yeah. Jack Webb, help me out here. Just a facts man, right. Just a facts man is what they're supposed to have said. Whether they actually said it in the program in the cave, I don't know. But, just a facts man, just a facts man. Give me the facts. Forget the theories, just give me the facts. Theory to William Jennings Bryan, as we'll see. Hypothesis to him. We'll see his definition of it in just a minute. What he thought a hypothesis was. He had a very low view of the scientific hypothesis. And evolution for him was a hypothesis. In the previous part, if you go back to this cartoon right here, you see the word hypothesis right there. It's one of the battleships of modernity. Hypothesis. Okay? Evolution is always called a hypothesis by fundamentalists. This is the Darwinian hypothesis of evolution. Now, in terms of the schools, here's the danger. The scientific hypothesis, right? The Darwinian hypothesis of evolution, which is really science falsely so-called. That's the phrase from 1 Timothy that's being used here to label evolution as a false science. Recall in chapter 6 of 1 Timothy, Paul advises Timothy to avoid vain babblings and science falsely so-called. That's how the King James Version puts it. Bryan takes that phrase, science falsely so-called, applies it to evolution. This phrase has a long history of usage in this way in America. I'm not going to go through that tonight. You can ask me about that afterward if you want. But it gets applied to evolution in the 20s by Bryan and the fundamentalists. And of course, this Pied Piper is leading the American children down the path of education toward a skull-shaped cave of disbelief in God of the Bible. Evolution, in other words, is not religiously neutral. I'd say many Americans today agree with that, though. Evolution is not religiously neutral, and it violates the neutrality of American public schools to teach it. Tens of millions of Americans probably believe that today, let alone in the 1920s. Astrotheistic evolution, Brian didn't think very much of. He said on one occasion that theistic evolution was the anesthetic that deadens the pain while the patient's faith is being gradually removed. A hypothesis for Brian was a guess. He said it's a fancy word for guess. And evolution is just guesses strung together. So, you see the situation. And this is something that virtually all, probably all fundamentalists I know of, at least, every fundamentalist whose views I know of from the 1920s, every one of the leaders would have agreed with Brian fully on this, that evolution is false, it's just a guess, it's never been proved, it's wrong, it's against the Bible, and it's dangerous to Christianity to teach in the public schools. It's got to come out. So that's the view that is there in America and still there in 1941 when the ASA was founded. Now here is a cartoon, also by Pace, that directly shows an idea William Jennings Bryan had. Bryan himself designed this cartoon, even though he didn't draw it. It was drawn by the cartoon professional artist Pace, but Bryan designed it. This cartoon first appeared in a book of William Jennings Bryan's, published in 1924, called Seven Questions in Dispute. It was a collection of articles he had published separately in the Sunday School Times. He wrote a letter to the editor of the Sunday School Times in which he said he wanted a new cartoon to appear in the book, in the front of the book. And he said it's a cartoon that would depict three well-dressed men going down a staircase on which there is no stopping place, i.e. a slippery slope. And they would show the three men, or they would represent the people who were most influenced by modernism. Now, what's modernism? Modernism was liberal Christianity at the time. Many modernist Protestants, people who used that word to identify themselves, modernist Christians, did not believe in the divinity of Jesus, or the bodily resurrection, or the virgin birth. Pretty serious things to disagree with. And many, not all modernists, but many modernists didn't believe in any of those three things. An example of the scientific community of this of a person like this would have been Arthur Holly Compton, the great Nobel laureate from University of Chicago. I knew his son, John Compton, a philosopher at Vanderbilt. He was my first department chair and my first academic job. And I wrote a study of Compton's religious beliefs for our journal a few years ago. You can read it there if you want. But when Compton was an elder in the Presbyterian Church in the 1940s and 50s, his son remembers Arthur Compton did not stand and recite the Apostles' Creed. And, you know, his son asked him one. He said, "Dad, why don't you do this?" And he said, "I don't want people to think I believe that." So that was Arthur Holly Compton. He was a theist, a very strong theist. He even used the term intelligent design, exactly that term, in a lecture he gave in the Unitarian Church in 1940, long before anybody even dreamed of an intelligent design movement. But Compton didn't believe in the Apostles' Creed, and he didn't want his fellow worshipers to think that he did. So Compton's attitude was typical for that of a modernist Christian of his generation. So understanding that now, the fundamentalists respond to modernism by rejecting that rejection of traditional Christian faith. And so they're concerned about modernism. And William Jennings Bryan is right on the top of the list of people who are worried about that. In fact, in the early 1920s, not long before the Scopes trial, Bryan runs for the top job in the Presbyterian Church. The Presbyterian Church is an annual general assembly. And in the early 20s, Bryan was one of the two final candidates to be the to be the moderator of the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church that year. He lost that election too. He lost that election to the president of one of the Presbyterian colleges in Ohio, in Marysville. And so Brian was involved with that wing of the church. He saw modernism as a great danger to the church. And he says that modernism is caused, he says, by evolution. He said evolution is, quote, the cause of modernism and of the progressive elimination of the vital truths of the Bible. That's how Brian put it in a letter he wrote to the editor of the Sunday School Times. Here we have these men going down the staircase. And remember, this is a slippery slope. There's no stopping place on the staircase. Here's what evolution leads to, in Brian's view. First, it leads to the student stepping from Bible not infallible to man not made in God's image. I'm now quoting from Brian's letter, which I've lectured on so many times, I kind of know it like a biblical text. Halfway down, a minister with a Bible in his hands, stepping from no deity, meaning no deity of Jesus, to no atonement. And then at the bottom, a scientist stepping from agnosticism to atheism. And you see how Haste, the cartoonist, has used light and shadow to add some subtlety to this picture of Brian's, which doesn't have any subtlety. And you have the minister clasping hands with the darkness halfway down, and then the scientist enshrouded in darkness at the bottom of the staircase. Brian saw Charles Darwin himself as the paradigm example of this. Someone who came to accept evolution, lost his Christian faith, ended up life as an agnostic, how Darwin saw it, or as an atheist, that's how many people portrayed Darwin, just as he's often portrayed today, inaccurately. Since Darwin himself never thought of himself as an atheist, denied it, as he says, but he's an agnostic. Now, it wasn't just science that threatened the Bible. As this next image shows, it was also modern biblical scholarship. This is another cartoon of E.J. Pace from the same period, and it shows the biblical scholar wearing the blinders of what we would call methodological naturalism, under which miracles cannot happen, and then concluding that there is no evidence for Christ's miracles. This is just one more example of science falsely so-called. And as you can see, this cartoon appeared exactly 1 year before the Scopes trial. So these are the concerns of the fundamentalist parents and families in the 1920s. Higher education is bringing atheism to their own children, and it's primarily in two forms. It's in the teaching of evolution and in biblical scholars who adopted this modern notion in biblical scholarship that there's no miracles, and therefore the Bible has to be read without miracles. And the bogeymen were college professors, as you can see here, wearing the mortarboards. Overall, the effect on American Christian youth was often to create doubts about the Bible and the whole Christian story. An atmosphere that's much like today, to be frank, in the opinions of many Christian parents today. This hasn't changed a whit in the years since the 1920s, in my opinion. Lots of things have, but not that. Arthur Gook, a missionary to Iceland, published a little book called Can a Young Man Trust His Bible? Just shortly after the turn of the century. And this is the attitude that Brian is concerned about. Now, given this unhelpful context, Will Houghton wanted to help lay Christians, especially college students, understand science and its limits more fully, so that they would not cave into the skeptics and lose their faith. He already had it in-house at Moody, a science expert of sorts, and that was Erwin Moon, the man you see on our left here, a California pastor who thrived on putting scientific demonstrations into his sermons. In 1938, Moody embraced Warren Moon's ministry, Erwin Moon's ministry, slip of the tongue indeed, under the title Sermons from Science. And this is the famous image of Erwin Moon having electricity flying off of his fingertips, which I saw when I saw the Sermons from Science demonstrations in New York City in 1964 at the World's Fair. where those servants from science had their whole pavilion of their own. They also had one in the Seattle World's Fair in the 1960s. Sermons from Science was right there at the center of the World's Fair. A few years later, after Moon got this off the ground, ASA founder Alton Everest would help Erwin Moon set up a state-of-the-art film production studio in LA. And Moon's films, which were glitzy, high-tech, full-color presentations of natural theology, culminating in the gospel message, would eventually be shown in major secular venues all over the world. That's a story in itself. It would take a whole separate talk to tell you about this. But among other things, they were used as official religious education in the United States Army in the 1950s, worldwide. And they were, you know, at these world's fairs, the films were translated into dozens of languages, literally shown. I say worldwide is not an exaggeration at all. And Alton Everest was right at the center of that, producing these kinds of films. We're going to see a very short clip of one of these coming up a little later. Now, on advice from Moon, Houghton invited five men to Chicago to start an organization of Christian scientists that would hold the line against the ungodly parts of modern science and serve as inspiring examples to the lay people. Let's meet those five men. The first was Alton Everest. He is, in my opinion, by far the most important person, not only in the ASA history at the time, but as his understanding of his discipline. He was the most widely respected person within his own professional community. There is, in fact, a Wikipedia page today devoted to Alton Everest, which talks about his accomplishments in sound engineering, which was his primary expertise. He wrote a major textbook on this. He taught at Oregon State, and he did a lot of secret work for the United States government during World War II on sonar. But this was Alton Everest. The next two of the five founders, on our left, a man who taught astronomy at Pasadena City College, the late Peter Stoner. And on our right, chemist Russell Sturgis from the Science College in Pennsylvania. And the last two of the five, on our left, John Van Heitsma, who taught biology at Calvin College. He very soon became quite inactive in the ASA, owing to health reasons and challenges during the war, teaching load and such. And Irving Cowperthwaite, who was an industrial chemist with Thomson Wire Company. He'd been educated, I think, at MIT. So these are the people who were brought together by Will Houghton to Chicago in 1941, in September 1941, on advice from Erwin Moon. Now, as Will Houghton knew full well, an earlier effort to make something similar happen at Moody had failed. In March 1936, a fledgling group called the Religion and Science Association held its first public meeting at Moody Church. The 31 full members of this group included the two men that you see here. On our left, George McCready Price, who was famously the founder of Flood Geology, a Seventh-day Adventist, former Canadian school teacher. And on our right, Harry Rimmer, the most widely visible anti-evolutionist in the United States, from the time of William Jennings Bryan's death right after the Stokes trial down through his death in 1952. In that period of time, he was the most widely visible anti-evolutionist. He traveled the country as an itinerant preacher every year, all over the country, giving series of sermons in city after city after city, speaking in major public venues like the largest auditorium in the city, or YMCA camps, or military bases, or big churches, colleges, and universities. This was Rimmer. And so he brought this powerful anti-evolution message. He was very influential on the views of these topics in Los Angeles. He lived on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, and he was influential on Biola and their views of science and faith there, and at Wheaton College, which gave him an honorary doctorate. Rimmer had been self-educated. He dropped out as he was thrown out of school as an incorrigible youth in the third grade up in Stockton, California. And he never had formal education again until college. He finished probably five semesters at four different schools, the last of which was Whittier, down here near Los Angeles. That was Rimmer's extent of Rimmer's formal education. Now, those members, those 31 members of this Religion and Science Association, also included some other people, but I won't tell you about who all they were. The organization soon disintegrated when its members could not agree on a particular view of Genesis. Rimmer was a heavy promoter of the gap theory, whereas for Price, that was unacceptable. Price was a literal six-day creationist who pushed flood geology. And you know, they couldn't agree at all, those two men, on those issues. Although Rimmer loved the fact that Price hated evolution, and he loved the fact that Price believed in the historicity of the flood. But you know, they just differed on these points. In the same way that Henry Morris, as we learned earlier today in one of the sessions, refused to endorse the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy. He was the only one of the people involved in that conversation who refused to endorse it because it didn't require young earth creation. Now, perhaps Houghton had learned from seeing what went down with the Religion and Science Association, because the ASA managed to survive despite an equally pronounced diversity of views among its members. In my opinion, which is shared by several other scholars of ASA history, the secret to our survival has been a willingness to keep the conversation going with charity and humility, rather than an eagerness to bring closure to questions that only defy closure. If we still exist 75 years from now, that will probably be the most important reason. At the same time, this limits our influence among lay Christians who badly want closure, even if that involves embracing bad science or bad theology. The ASA founders saw the horns of this dilemma and faced them squarely. Now, the founding documents of the ASA judiciously failed to identify any specific biblical interpretations endorsed by the organization. They also prophetically failed even to mention evolution, let alone spell out that members should reject it. The creedal statement in the original Constitution, which members were expected to affirm, says only that, quote, "I cannot conceive of discrepancies between statements in the Bible and the real facts of science," end quote. I'll read it again. "I cannot conceive of discrepancies between statements in the Bible and the real facts of science." The founders were all creationists of one sort or another, who did not place evolution among the real facts of science. At the same time, they were anxious not to erect fences that might keep out fellow travelers with whom they might have mutually beneficial conversations. Perhaps it didn't even occur to them that there might come a time when other Bible-believing scientists would even accept evolution, let alone want to join the ASA while holding such views. But they did not forestall that possibility from the outset. Now, World War II ultimately helped to make that possibility a reality, even though its immediate effect on the ASA was not positive. Members were either involved in war work themselves, such as Mr. Everest, or saw their workloads increase as the whole nation was immersed in the war effort. Nevertheless, by the time the war ended in August 1945, there were about 60 ASA members. So it grew, you know, it went from 5 to 60 in those 4 years. During the Cold War, the federal government became a major player in higher education and the major player in funding scientific research. In my opinion, this is the big influence of World War II on the ASA. It's not a direct influence, it's an indirect influence by what the war did to the American psyche during the Cold War and what Congress did as a result of that. The GI Bill underwrote a veritable explosion in college enrollments. which almost doubled from 1940 to 1950. Now, the numbers are not as clear as they should be in my head, but I think if I recall correctly, it's something like 1.5 million Americans enrolled in college in 1940, and about 2.7 million by 1950. So that's about an 80% increase. That's an enormous increase in a 10-year period. And that is almost certainly a direct result of the GI Bill. Even though most of the people who benefited directly from the GI Bill were men, since they were war veterans, there have been some women who were war veterans too, as we all know. The families who get affected by that increased education continue. And of course, other forms of federal aid are developed not too long after that, like the National Defense Student Loans that become the National Direct Student Loans that become the student loans today. And that happens in the 1950s. So also late in the decade, in the year 1950, the National Science Foundation begins. And the federal government becomes the major player in scientific research in the United States. That wasn't true until this point in time. The federal government was not involved in scientific research unrelated to defense prior to the formation of the NSF. Indeed, the biggest science funding ever, as far as I know, the biggest science funding ever by a government to science was the Manhattan Project in World War II. That's the beginning of big science, and big science takes off in the Cold War as the National Science Foundation comes along, and then later, of course, the National Institutes of Health, which has a budget even bigger than the NSF. But the National Institutes of Health was later than the NSF. And so, late in the 1950s, the NSF gets involved heavily in high school science education. Now, of course, in this country, the federal government isn't responsible constitutionally for education. States are. And this is the federal government doesn't tell the states, cannot tell school districts which textbooks they can use. But they can provide funding to prepare textbooks that states and districts can adopt. And that's what they did beginning in the late 50s. All three of the major high school sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, get revamped at the high school level with fancy new textbooks paid for by federal dollars. And in biology, it's the famous or infamous BSCS curriculum. Biological Sciences Study Committee, BSCS, under which I had biology when I was in high school in the 1960s. For the first time since the Scopes trial, evolution is front and center in biology textbooks. Now let me explain that. It wasn't the case that the Scopes trial forced biology textbooks to remove evolution. That's not true at all. What happened was publishers of biology textbooks voluntarily made the decision to pull evolution out after the Scopes trial. And so that for roughly 35 years, evolution was largely missing as the central concept, and often not even in the index, of high school biology books. And that didn't change until BSCS and roughly 1960 when that really starts to be used. And of course, Whitcomb and Morris are right around the corner in 1961. Now, the ASA weighed in officially on biology textbooks in 1986, as we heard in a talk earlier today, with the ill-fated publication called Teaching Science in a Climate of Controversy. I won't say more about that here tonight. Just want to point out in mind, we did weigh in on this eventually. The ad hoc committee that wrote this publication was called the Committee for Integrity in Science Education. Now, overall, at this point in time, Cold War context, far more conservative Protestants were being educated in science than before the war. And evolution was a much bigger part of the picture than it had been before. As the ASA expanded by attracting younger scientists, more members were open to evolution or fully accepting of it than in the first decade of the ASA. Far more. Okay, that's a lot to fly on so far, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Let's go back to 1946, right after World War II, and the ASA has its first annual meeting in 1946. Here's the answer to one of your trivia questions. You better be taking notes on this. This is on the final exam. Now, the ASA held its first annual meeting at Wheaton College. Registration cost $1, And a dormitory room exclusive of meals was $1 a night. The only woman in the picture here, Frida Monsma, accompanied her husband, Edwin Monsma. There's Frida, there's Ed Monsma. Ed Monsma was a biology professor at Calvin College. And only a small handful of women were involved with the ASA in its early years. Frida wasn't involved with the meeting. She just came along with her husband to the meeting. Did they really dress up in this 1940s? ASA meetings? This was hot. Who does that? In 1948, 2 years later, there were no women among the 77 ASA members. And you probably gathered that that was true for a number of years yet by seeing who stood up tonight as 40-year-plus members, right? And I missed it by 1 year. I'm a guy too. But no women officially appeared on the program of the ASA until the fourth meeting in 1949, when there were two. One of them was a young woman just hired to teach geology at Wheaton, a woman named Cordelia Erdman. And the other person was also from Wheaton, Angeline Brandt, a mathematics professor. She had a long career at Wheaton. Cordelia did not have a long career at Wheaton. However, anthropologist Marie Fetzer, also of Wheaton, she was had just finished a master's degree, I think at Columbia, read a crucial paper by Columbia geochemist J. Lawrence Culp, who could not attend. I'm going to come back to him, Culp, and that paper in just a little bit. Erdman and Fetzer spoke again the following year when they were joined on the program by Goshen biologist Alta Schrock. You see the three of them here. During the entire decade of the 1950s, a total of four women wrote the grand total of less than 3% of the papers published in the ASA Journal. All the papers published by the women in the ASA Journal were written by four women, total of four women. You see three of them here. Although several women have served on council, especially in this century, 2016 is the first annual meeting presided over by a female CEO. We have indeed come a long way, but it's worth remembering that until the 1970s, the biographical dictionary of AAAS members was called this. You're looking at the 1933 edition, which I own. It contains three of the founders are in this. American Men of Science, which had some women of science, but the term woman of science I have never seen in the literature. I very often see the term man of science as a synonym for science right down to the 1960s. And indeed, that was the name of the biographical dictionary of AAAS. So our forebears in the ASA were hardly exceptional in this respect. Attendees at that first meeting were shown one of Irwin Moon's films, God of Creation. Several other Moody films were seen in other annual meetings throughout the 50s. We're going to watch a few minutes of one right now, and here I'm going to have to ask back at the desk if they'll turn this on for me, since I don't have my laptop up here. So we'll go to that link, please. And then when we get there, please magnify the picture to full page size. And then I'll tell you when we want to turn it off.
But now, and rockets 100 miles above the Earth are giving us a glimpse of what the passengers
of Mars will
say.
I should point out that's not the film God of Creation that I wanted, but it's probably a question of which link got hit which where, so we won't worry about that. That film was one of the very typical of the whole series. Now, big changes took place in the ASA from 1947 to 1959. So let's take a look at some of those. Here's the attendees at the 1947 meeting, the second ASA meeting. They're still all men, but what I want to point out in this case is that there are three people in this photograph. There's 19 people here, I think, all together, and three of them. William Tinkle, right here on the back row. The biblical scholar, R. Laird Harris, right here, who's from Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, right here. And Ed Monsma, whom I mentioned earlier, his wife, he's the one whose wife accompanied me in the previous year, right there. Those three men are three of the 10 founders of the Creation Research Society from 1963. Now, Harris wasn't a young earth creationist. He was a gap theory proponent. And that got him thrown out of the Creation Research Society a couple of years after he served as one of the founding 10 members. When Tinkle kind of brought the hammer down on people who weren't strict young earth creationists. But that's part of what happens in that in the period after 1947. The same year as that meeting, the Moody Monthly publishes this cartoon. This one's not by Ernest James Pace, it's by a man named U.S. Abel. And it is, you can see the view of evolution shown here. Evolution is kind of poisoning the well, if you are poisoning the water tower. This is what's happening in many of our institutions of learning, and who's going to warn the students? And that's in the same issue in which Alton Everest publishes an article, Can We Be Christians in Science? In that very same issue. It's 1947. In 1949, the ASA starts publishing its own journal. This is not the first copy. This is my earliest copy, volume 2, number 1. But volume 1, number 1, looked exactly like this. And if you open it up, it's basically mimeographed text inside. And that was true for the first several years of the journal. And Columbia chemist Marion Barnes was the editor of the journal, the first editor. And here's what he wrote introducing it. The purpose of the ASA bulletin is manifold. It is intended primarily for the benefit of the ASA members and its interested friends. And it is hoped that it will be an instrumental in helping the organization achieve its primary purpose of witnessing to the truth of the scriptures and elucidating the relationship of both the ideology and fruits of science thereto. So, you know, that fancy prose consistent with what we learned earlier about why the ASA was formed. The Biola meeting in 1949, I don't know whether this was the first ASA field trip, but it's the first one I know about. And it went to La Brea Tar Pits. And there was another ASA field trip to Mount Palomar that founder Peter Stoner arranged. Now, the influence of Larry Culp was very important in the early ASA. I had mentioned before, when I talked about the women, that there was a woman who read one of Culp's papers at the 1949 bio meeting. This picture was taken the next year at the Goshen College meeting, this picture of Culp. He couldn't attend the 1949 meeting, but he wrote a paper for it that was read in his place, and it was a paper attacking flood geology, especially the views of George McCready Price. Price sat in front row when the paper was read, and there's no discussion of the paper on Price's part that's recorded. Everest has asked him, or someone asked him after, whether it was Everest or someone else, Everest reports this, that he was asked what he thought about all this, and he had a kind of non-committal comment. But that led to a flurry within the ASA over the next several years. Culp was a very, very important research scientist. He was one of the people, movers and shakers, behind forming Lamont Geophysical Laboratory at Columbia, and he was one of the creators of geochronology, the whole science of radioactive dating. And one of Culp's students, I believe, is in the room. Is Ken Waldenwith here? Ken, weren't you one of Culp's students?
I was one step down. Larry Culp went and started the geochemistry program at Columbia, and then the chemistry chairman at Wheaton sent a series of students, and I was one of those, and I was a student of Wally Grover, who was Larry Culp's student.
There you go. So we have connections with Larry Culp right here in this room. Another early important influence was Bernard Ramm, who, according to at least one prominent authority, the Evangelical Dictionary of Evangelical Theology, considers him, with Carl Henry, to be one of the two greatest evangelical theologians of the 20th century. Now, I'm not qualified enough as a student of theology to say whether I agree with that, but there are those who think he was. Ramm was certainly a very influential voice in the early ASA. He was teaching at Biola from 1944 through the early 50s. He was teaching a course in apologetics called Bible and Science. He was actually a professor of apologetics at Biola. At the time, he was a graduate student in the philosophy of science at USC, where he studied under one of the logical positivist philosophers who was there. And so that was his training. He actually didn't have a doctorate in theology, even though he had seminary training at Eastern Seminary, Eastern Baptist in Philadelphia, in fact. He was a professor of apologetics, and he had this grad student in philosophy of science. His first book was based on lectures he gave at Biola when he distanced himself from Harry Reimer's ideas, which were prominent at Biola at the time. And that book is called The Christian View of Science and Scripture. As Walt and many others know, that wasn't his idea of the title. I can't remember his idea of the title, but that was the publisher's idea. A Christian View of Science and Scripture, okay? And the publisher made it The Christian View of Science and Scripture. And so there's Bernie Ramm. Subtle difference, but very important, obviously. This was a time when American conservative Christianity was changing rapidly, with the rise of the people who described themselves as neo-evangelicals. People like Carl Henry, who you see here on our left, the founding editor of Christianity Today, and on our right, a young Billy Graham, who was criticized very heavily by many fundamentalist leaders for not separating from those who didn't separate, and for inviting, you know, a broad range of preachers to participate in his crusades in American cities. Attitudes, in other words, in American conservative religion were changing. I remember my mother, who knew Billy Graham, because she was at Wheaton College with him. My mother, whose roommate in college was Elizabeth Howard Elliott, the very, very famous Christian writer whose husband was killed by the Aka Indians. And my mother used to tell me that the definition of an evangelical was children of fundamentalists, or evangelicals. That goes back to this period in the 1940s when these things were starting to change very rapidly. And Walt referred to the same thing in his comments earlier. People in the ASA were interested, by and large, with distancing themselves from some of the attitudes of the previous generation. They didn't disagree with them theologically at all, but they wanted different attitudes toward modernity. So in 1959, Russ Mixter, a professor of biology at Wheaton, was one of the movers and shakers in the early ASA, edited a book called Evolution and Christian Thought Today. What is significant about the year 1959 in relation to evolution? Can you see it? Yeah, 100th anniversary of the Origin of Species. And there were huge celebrations in scientific circles about that, commemorating that. And the ASA saw the possibility of this book. Carl Henry, by the way, wrote the final chapter, which has no bearing on any of the other chapters at all. It's not clear that he's interacted with any of these other chapters, read any of the other things. But he writes the final chapter in this book. And I believe Walter Hearn wrote a chapter in this book, is that right? And you're with your student, Dick Henry?
Yes.
Okay.
Origin of Life.
On the Origin of Life, exactly. Okay. And just 2 years later, Henry Morris and John Whitcomb, who met through the ASA, when Whitcomb heard Morris give a lecture at an ASA meeting in, I think, in Winona Lake, joined forces to publish John Whitcomb's doctoral dissertation, a fancied up version with lots more science in it that Morris helped provide, the Genesis Flood. Whitcomb's doctoral dissertation was based upon the ideas of George McCready Price, the Adventist flood geologist. That's very clear in the dissertation. The published version significantly mutes that connection with Price, tries to ignore it or play it down. But it's unchanged, basically, in the magnitude of the influence. And so young Earth creationism becomes a big American phenomenon after this book, which is still in print and has sold something like 300,000 copies in print. The answers in Genesis cartoon you see here looks like some things you've seen earlier in some ways, and culture wars are still with us with regard to science, really here. Richard Bube's influence was discussed earlier today in a number of meetings and papers that we heard here. He became the editor of the ASA Journal in the late 60s up through the early 80s, an enormously important influence on the development of ASA Journal. He was a professor of material science at Stanford and the author of a major textbook in his field from Princeton University Press. He was a top American scientist who was editing the journal at the time. He wrote a very famous essay called Creation and/or Evolution that I recommend to all of you. You can easily find it in our archives. Look for notice how he puts it, and/or evolution. To bring us up now to date and wrap it up, these are four of the five speakers at the meeting we had at Pepperdine in 2002. I was the program chair that year, which is why this photograph is in my archive, but it makes the point I want to make. Here's four pretty significant people from the American scientific community. Ian Hutchinson, the nuclear engineer from MIT, who was in charge of the Al-Qaeda project, the plasma physics project there. Owen Gingerich, the famous astronomer and historian of science from Harvard. A young woman named Jennifer Wiseman. I hear she's here now. She was a Christian pioneer of science and public policy because at the time she was working with the United States Congress, science advisor. And someone called Francis Collins. He's a little better known today than he was in 2002. The fifth speaker missing from this photograph, he hadn't arrived yet, was the late Charlie Towns, the Nobel laureate for the invention of the maser, which led to the laser. So this is a very different American scientific affiliation than it was in 1946, in that first meeting, or in 1941 at the founding. In my last image, here's some of the audience. On the lawn of the President's House at Pepperdine, it's something like 500 feet above the Pacific Ocean. So we're now 75 years old. We're the oldest organization of Christians in the sciences in North America. Can we keep it alive, growing, and growing in influence? Well, that's up to you. And my only request or advice, if I'm old enough to give it, would be this. Do your best to implement a plan which, when I was briefly ASA president, I called 1 and 1 and 1. Attend at least one ASA meeting every 5 years. Recruit at least one new member who will stay the course, and give 1% of your estate to the ASA Endowment Fund. If we all do that, they will remember us with appreciation at the 150th anniversary meeting in 2091, which I will probably miss. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you so much, Ted. I think that was very helpful. I don't know if we really have time for questions at this point, but I think that all of you can appreciate now the kind of background that we have for this organization, the value that it provides, and the challenge that we have before us, which in ways that hadn't struck me before was, on one hand, how similar it is to the situation that was back then. I didn't realize the degree of similarity. And on the other hand, how much things have changed in the scientific world. We have a big difference to that. So, again, thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Vicki.